Chapter 2 On the way home, in the monorail, she suddenly broke into tears. Nobody noticed. Crowded in the car, people tired from work and dulled by the long, rocking ride all sat watching the holopro above the aisle. Children doing gymnastics. Hundreds of tiny children in red uniforms kicking and jumping in unison to shrill, cheery music in the air. On the long climb up the stairs to her apartment, she wept again. There was no reason to cry. There had to be a reason. She must be sick. The misery she felt was fear, a wretched panic of fear, dread, terror. It was crazy to send her off on her own. Tongue was crazy to think of it. She could never handle it. She sat down at her work desk to send him a formal request for return to Terra. The heinous words would not come. They were all wrong. Her head ached. She got up to find something to eat. There was nothing in her food storage, nothing at all. When had she eaten last? Not at midday, not in the morning, not last night. "What's wrong with me?" she said to the air. No wonder her stomach hurt. No wonder she had fits of weeping and panic. She had never in her life forgotten to eat. Even in that time, the time after, when she went back to Chile, even then she had cooked food and eaten it, forcing food salty with tears down her throat day after day after day. "I won't do this," she said. She didn't know what she meant. She refused to go on crying. She walked back down the stairs, flashed her Zill at the exit, walked 10 blocks to the nearest Corp Star food shop, flashed her Zill at the entrance. All the foods were packaged, processed, frozen, convenient. Nothing fresh, nothing to cook. The sight of the wrapped rose made her tears break out again. Furious and humiliated, she bought a hot stuffed roll at the Eat Quick counter. The man serving was too busy to look at her face. She stood outside the shop on the street, turned away from people passing by, and crammed the food into her mouth, salty with tears. Forced herself to swallow, just like back then, back there. Back then she had known she had to live. It was her job. To live life after joy. Leave love and death behind her. Go on. Go alone and work. And now she was going to ask to get sent back to Earth? Back to death? She chewed and swallowed. Music and slogans blared in broken bursts from passing vehicles. The light at a crossing 4 blocks away had failed, and robocab horns outblared the music. People on foot, the producer-consumers of the corporation state, in uniforms of rust, tan, blue, green, or in corporation-made standard trousers, tunics, jackets, all wearing canvas star-marked shoes, came crowding past, coming up from the underground garages, hurrying toward one apartment house or another. Suddy chewed and swallowed the last tough, sweet-salt lump of food. She would not go back. She would go on. Go alone and work. She went back to her apartment house, flashed her Zill at the entrance, and climbed the 8 flights of stairs. She had been given a big, flashy, top-floor apartment because it was considered suitable for an honored guest of the corporation state. The elevator had not been working for a month. She nearly missed the boat. The robocab got lost trying to find the river. It took her to the aquarium, then to the Bureau of Water Resources and Processing, then to the aquarium again. She had to override it and reprogram it 3 times. As she scurried across the wharf, the crew of Eraha River Ferry 8 was just pulling in the gangway. She shouted. They shoved the gangway back down. She scrambled aboard. She tossed her bags into her tiny cabin and came out on deck to watch the city go by. It showed a dingier, quieter side down here on the water, far under the canyon walls of the blocks and towers of business and government. Beneath huge concrete embankments were wooden docks and warehouses black with age, a water beetle come and go of little boats on errands that were no doubt beneath the notice of the Ministry of Commerce. And houseboat communities wreathed in flowering vines, flapping laundry, and the stink of sewage. A stream ran through a concrete ditch between high, dark walls to join the great river. Above it, a fisherman leaned on the rail of a humpback bridge. A silhouette, simple, immobile, timeless. The image of a drawing in one of the Aachen books they had partially salvaged from the lost transmission. How reverently she had handled those few pages of images, lines of poems, fragments of prose. How she had pored over them back in Valparaiso, trying to feel from them what these people of another world were like, longing to know them. It had been hard to erase the copies from her noter, here, and no matter what Tong said, she still felt it as a wrong, a capitulation to the enemy. She had studied the copies in her noter one last time, lovingly, painfully, trying to hold on to them before she deleted them. "And there are no footprints in the dust behind us." She had shut her eyes as she deleted that poem. Doing so, she felt that she was erasing all her yearning hope that when she came to Akka, she'd learn what it was about. But she remembered the four lines of the poem, and the hope and yearning were still there. The quiet engines of Ferry 8 drummed softly. Hour by hour, the embankments grew lower, older, more often broken by stairs and landings. At last, they sank away altogether into mud and reeds and shrubby banks, and the Araha spread itself out wider and wider, and amazingly wider across a flatness of green and yellow-green fields. For 5 days, the boat, moving steadily eastward on that steady breadth of water through mild sunshine and mild starry darkness, was the tallest thing in sight. Now and then it came to a riverside city where it would tie up at an old dock dwarfed under high new office and apartment towers and take on supplies and passengers. Sadi found it amazingly easy to talk to people on the boat. In Dovza City, everything had conspired to keep her reserved and silent. Though the four off-worlders were given apartments and a certain freedom of movement, the corporation scheduled their lives very closely with appointments, programming and supervising their work and amusements. Not that they were the only ones so controlled. Akka's abrupt and tremendous technological advance was sustained by rigid discipline universally enforced and self-enforced. It seemed that everybody in the city worked hard, worked long hours, slept short hours, ate in haste. Every hour was scheduled. Everybody she'd been in touch with in the ministries of poetry and of information knew exactly what they wanted her to do and how she should do it. And as soon as she started doing as they directed, they hurried off about their business, leaving her to hers. Though the technologies and achievements of the ecumenical worlds were held as the shining model for everything on Akka, the four visitors from the ecumen were kept, as Tong said, in a fish tank. From time to time they were put on display to the public and in the Nerials, smiling figures sitting at a corporation banquet or somewhere near the chief of a bureau giving a speech. But they were not asked to speak. Only to smile. Possibly the ministers did not trust them to say exactly what they ought to say. Possibly the ministers found them rather flat, dull examples of the superior civilizations Akka was striving so hard to emulate. Most civilizations, perhaps, look shinier in general terms and from several light years away. Though Sadi had met many Akkans and disliked few of them, after a half year on the planet she had scarcely had anything deserving the name of a conversation with any one of them. She had seen nothing of Akkan private life except the stiff dinner parties of upper-level bureaucrats and corporation officials. No personal friendship had ever come even remotely into view. No doubt the people she met had been advised not to talk with her more than necessary, so that the corporation could remain in full control of the information she received. But even with people she saw constantly, intimacy did not grow. She did not feel this distance as prejudice, xenophobia. The Aachens were remarkably unconcerned about foreignness as such. It was that they were all so busy, and all bureaucrats. Conversation went by program. At the banquets, people talked business, sports, and technology. Waiting in lines or at the laundry, they talked sports and the latest near reels. They avoided the personal, and in public, repeated the corporation line on all matters of policy and opinion, to the point of contradicting her when her description of her world didn't tally with what they had been taught about wonderful, advanced, resourceful Terra. But on the riverboat, people talked. They talked personally, intimately, and exhaustively. They leaned on the railing talking, sat around on the deck talking, stayed at the dinner table with a glass of wine talking. A word or smile from her was enough to include her in their talk. And she realized, slowly, because it took her by surprise, that they didn't know she was an alien. They all knew there were observers from the Ecumen on Akka. They'd seen them on the near reels. Four infinitely remote, meaningless figures among the ministers and executives, stuffed aliens among the stuffed shirts. But they had no expectation of meeting one among ordinary people. She had expected not only to be recognized, but to be set apart and kept at a remove wherever she traveled. But no guides had been offered, and no supervisors were apparent. It seemed that the corporation had decided to let her be genuinely on her own. She had been on her own in the city, but in the fish tank, a bubble of isolation. The bubble had popped. She was outside. It was a little frightening when she thought about it, but she didn't think much about it, because it was such a pleasure. She was accepted. One of the travelers. One of the crowd. She didn't have to explain, didn't have to evade explanation, because they didn't ask. She spoke Dovzan with no more accent, indeed less, than many Akkans from regions other than Dovza. People assumed from her physical type, short, slight, dark-skinned, that she came from the east of the continent. "You're from the east, aren't you?" they said. "My cousin Muniti married a man from Turu." And then they went on talking about themselves. She heard about them, their cousins, their families, their jobs, their opinions, their houses, their hernias. People with pets traveled by riverboat, she discovered, petting a woman's furry and affable kitty pup. People who disliked or feared flying took the boat, as a chatty old gentleman told her in vast detail. People not in a hurry went by boat and told each other their stories. Suddy got told even more stories than most, because she listened without interrupting, except to say, "Really? What happened then?" And, "How wonderful!" Or, "How terrible!" She listened with greed, tireless. These dull and fragmentary relations of ordinary lives could not bore her. Everything she had missed in Dovza City, everything the official literature, the heroic propaganda left out, they told. If she had to choose between heroes and hernias, it was no contest. As they got farther upstream, deeper inland, passengers of a different kind began to come aboard. Country people used the riverboat as the simplest and cheapest way to get from one town to another. Walk onto the boat here and get off it there. The towns were smaller now, without tall buildings. By the seventh day, passengers were boarding not with pets and luggage, but with fowls in baskets, goats on leashes. They weren't exactly goats, or deer, or cows, or any other earthly thing. They were Eberdine. But they blatted, and had silky hair, and in Suddy's mental ecology, they occupied the goat niche. They were raised for milk, meat, and the silky hair. In the old days, according to a bright-colored page of a picture book that had survived the lost transmission, Eberdine had pulled carts and even carried riders. She remembered the blue and red banners on the cart, and the inscription under the picture, "Setting off for the Golden Mountain." She wondered if it had been a fantasy for children, or a larger breed of Eberdine. Nobody could ride these. They were only about knee-high. By the eighth day, they were coming aboard in flocks. The aft deck was knee-deep in Eberdine. The city folk with pets and the aerophobes had all disembarked early that morning at Eltley, a big town that ran a railway line up into the South Headwaters Range resort country. Near Eltley, the Araha went through three locks, one very deep. Above them, it was a different river, wilder, narrower, faster, its water not cloudy blue-brown, but airy blue-green. Long conversations also ended at Eltley. The country folk now on the boat were not unfriendly, but were shy of strangers, talking mostly to their own acquaintances, in dialect. Suddy welcomed her recovered solitude, which left her eyes to see. Off to the left, as the stream bent north, mountain peaks spired up one after another, black rock, white glaciers. Ahead of the boat, upstream, no peaks were visible, nothing dramatic. The land just went slowly up and up and up. And Ferry 8, now full of blatting and squawking and the quiet intermittent voices of the country people and smelling of manure, fried bread, fish, and sweet melons, moved slowly, her silent engines working hard against the drastic current, between wide rocky shores and treeless plains of thin, pale, plumy grass. Curtains of rain swept across the land, dropping from vast, quick clouds, and trailed off, leaving sunlight, diamond air, the fragrance of the soil. Night was silent, cold, starlit. Suddy stayed up late and waked early. She came out on deck. The east was brightening. Over the shadowy western plains, dawn lit the far peaks one by one like matches. The boat stopped where no town or village was, no sign of habitation. A woman in fleece tunic and felt hat crowded her flock onto the gangplank, and they ran ashore, she running with them, shouting curses at them and raucous goodbyes to friends aboard. From the aft rail, Suddy watched the flock for miles, a shrinking, pale blot on the gray-gold plain. All that ninth day passed in a trance of light. The boat moved slowly. The river, now clear as the wind, rushed by so silently that the boat seemed to float above it, between two airs. All around them were levels of rock and pale grass, pale distances. The mountains were lost, hidden by the vast swell of rising land. Land and sky and the river crossing from one to the other. "This is a longer journey," Suddy thought, standing again at the rail that evening, "than my journey from Earth to Akka." And she thought of Tong Av, who might have made this journey himself and had given it to her to make, and wondered how to thank him. By seeing, by describing, by recording, yes. But she could not record her happiness. The word itself destroyed it. She thought, Pau should be here. By me. She would have been here. We would have been happy. The air darkened, the water held the light. One other person was on deck. He was the only other passenger who had been on the boat all the way from the capital, a silent 40-ish man, a corporation official in blue and tan. Uniforms were ubiquitous on Akka. Schoolchildren wore scarlet shorts and tunics. Masses and lines and little hopping dots of brilliant red all over the streets of the cities, a startling, cheerful sight. College students wore green and rust. Blue and tan was the sociocultural bureau, which included the Central Ministry of Poetry and Art and the World Ministry of Information. Suddy was very familiar with blue and tan. Poets wore blue and tan, official poets at any rate, and producers of tapes and near-reels, and librarians and bureaucrats in branches of the bureau with which Suddy was less familiar, such as ethical purity. The insignia on this man's jacket identified him as a monitor, fairly high in the hierarchy. When she was first aboard, expecting some kind of official presence or supervision, some watchdog watching her excursion, Suddy had waited for him to show some attention to her or evidence of keeping an eye on her. She saw nothing of the kind. If he knew who she was, nothing in his demeanor showed it. He had been entirely silent and aloof, ate at the captain's table at meals, communicated only with his noter, and avoided the groups of talkers that she always joined. Now he came to stand at the rail not far from her. She nodded and ignored him, which was what he had always appeared to want. But he spoke, breaking the intense silence of the vast dusk landscape, where only the water murmured its resistance quietly and fiercely to the boat's prow and sides.
A dreary country, the monitor said.
His voice roused a young Aberdeen tied to a stanchion nearby. It bleated softly,
ma, ma,
and shook its head.
Baron, the man said, backward. Are you interested in lover's eyes?
Ma, ma,
said the little Aberdeen. Excuse me, said Suddy.
Lover's eyes. Gems, jewels.
Why are they called that?
Primitive fancy, imagined resemblance.
The man's glance crossed hers for a moment. Insofar as she had thought anything about him at all, she had thought him stiff and dull, a little egocrat. The cold keenness of his look surprised her.
They're found along stream banks in the high country. Only there, he said, pointing upstream, and only on this planet. I take it some other interest brought you here.
He did know who she was then. And from his manner, he wished her to know that he disapproved of her being on the loose, on her own. In the short time I've been on Akka, I've seen only Duvza City. I received permission to do some sightseeing.
To go upriver, the man said with a tight pseudo-smile.
He waited for more. She felt a pressure from him, an expectancy, as if he considered her accountable to him. She resisted. He gazed at the purplish plains fading into night, and then down at the water that seemed still to hold some transparency of light within it. He said,
Duvza is a land of beautiful scenery. Rich farmlands, prosperous industries, delightful resorts in the South Headwaters Range. Having seen nothing of that, why did you choose to visit this desert?
I come from a desert, Suddy said. That shut him up for a bit.
We know that Terra is a rich, progressive world.
His voice was dark with disapproval. Some of my world is fertile. Much of it is still barren. We have misused it badly. It's a whole world, Monitor, with room enough for a lot of variety, just as here. She heard the note of challenge in her voice.
Yet you prefer barren places and backward methods of travel?
This was not the exaggerated respect shown her by people in Duvza City, who had treated her as a fragile exotic that must be sheltered from reality. This was suspicion, distrust. He was telling her that aliens should not be allowed to wander about alone. The first xenophobia she'd met on Akka. I like boats, she said with care, pleasantly, and I find this country beautiful. Austere, but beautiful. Don't you?
No, he said, an order. No disagreement allowed.
The corporate, official voice. So what brings you up the river? Are you looking for lover's eyes?
She spoke lightly, even a bit flirtily, allowing him to change tone and get out of the challenge response mode if he wanted to.
He didn't.
Business, he said.
Vizdiat, the ultimate Akan justification, the inarguable aim, the bottom line.
There are pockets of cultural fossilization and recalcitrant reactionary activity in this area. I hope you have no intention of traveling out of town into the high country. Where education has not yet reached, the natives are brutal and dangerous. Insofar as I have jurisdiction in this area, I must ask you to remain in touch with my office at all times, to report any evidence of illegal practices, and to inform us if you plan to travel.
I appreciate your concern, and shall endeavor to comply with your request, Suddy said, straight out of Advanced Exercises in Duvzen Usage and Locutions for Barbarians. The monitor nodded once, his eyes on the slowly passing, slowly darkening shore. When she looked again where he had stood, he was gone.